Good afternoon. We are starting our meeting for the September 6, 2022, regular meeting of the Chatham County Savannah Metropolitan Planning Commission. Will now come to order. I will ask Mr. Joseph Urban to please lead us in prayer and afterwards the Pledge of Allegiance. Everyone stand, please. Thank you. Amen. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. For those in the audience and online, I will read out our procedures as to be followed for the meeting today. The agenda is broken down into several parts. First, notices, proclamations, and acknowledgments. Next, the consent agenda, which consists of items for which the applicant is in agreement with the staff recommendation, and there are no known objections. This will be followed by regular business, old business, and adjournment. For each agenda item on regular business, the staff will make a presentation. The staff presentation will be followed by a presentation of the petitioner, should they elect to do so. The petitioner will be allotted a time frame of no more than 20 minutes. The board may then ask questions of the petitioner or staff for clarification. Afterwards, the floor will be open for public comment. If you wish to comment on the item that the board is considering at the time, members of the public that are in person must fill out a speaker card and give to staff. If you are participating virtually, use the raise your hand feature on your computer, please, at home. That's on your computer screen. Do not use the feature until the item you want to comment on is being considered. At the appropriate time, you'll be recognized and staff will unmute your microphone. At the end of your allotted time, as determined by the chair, your microphone will be muted and the chair will recognize the next speaker. The total public comment time will be equivalent to the petitioner's presentation time. Therefore, it is important that you use the raise your hand feature on your computer if you're at home participating today, if you want to speak on the petition. Once the floor is closed for public comment on the petition, no additional public speakers will be allowed. If you are not certain you want to speak, still use the raise your hand feature, or if in person, fill out the speaker card. You will have the option to decline when your name is called. After public comment, the petitioner will have the opportunity for rebuttal, and then additionally, the questions by the board will take place. Finally, the board will take action. Thank you. I appreciated the added verbiage to that, ladies. So, we have approval of the agenda. Need motion, a motion?
Motion to approve, Noah.
Second, Coles.
We'll take a verbal vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you. Next, we'll go to notices, proclamations, and acknowledgments. Item two, meeting date change from Tuesday, September 27th to Thursday, the 29th of this month. Regular planning meeting be held here at 1:30 p.m. Again, from the 27th to the 29th, where it is moved to. Notices Thursday, September 29th will be the regular MPC meeting at 1:30. You just said that. Next will be items to be requested to be removed from the final agenda. Map amendment, Wild Heron Road, rezoned from A1 to RMF1 and RSF4. Master plan, Cottonvale Road. Master plan amendment, 1901 Benton Boulevard. Item seven, map amendment, 1806 Live Oak Street, rezoned from RSF 5 to TR2. Text amendment, item eight, allow cafe and office districts. Anybody here on those items? Those have been removed for today's agenda. I need a motion.
Noah, motion to remove.
Cole, second.
We'll do a verbal vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank you. For today, items requested to be withdrawn. Item 9, map amendment 543 Washington Avenue. Anybody here on that item? Well, that will not take place today. I need a motion.
Noah, motion to withdraw.
Cole, second.
Verbal vote, all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Thank you. Then we'll move now to consent agenda. Approval of the August 16th, 2022 briefing and regular minutes. I need a motion.
Motion to approve, and a thank you to Ms. Sally for 40 pages of typed minutes.
Cole, second.
Verbal vote, all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone oppose? There will be no old business today. We go now to regular business. Item number 11, map amendment 362 Fort Argyle Road, rezoned from A1 to IL.
Good afternoon, Mr. Commissioner, to Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, Melissa Leto and PC staff. The petitioner, Tara Williams, is requesting a rezoning of a parcel from an agricultural district to a light industrial classification. The subject property is located at 362 Fort Argyle Road. It includes three lots. I'll show that here. There's lots C, B, and A, and it includes approximately 5.35 acres or 233,046 square feet in lot area, and there is a 357-foot frontage along Fort Argyle Road. The area has traditionally been rural in use with large lot sizes. Again, the property is currently zoned agricultural. The petitioner states in their application that the purpose of the rezoning request to light industrial zoning classification is due to many of the surrounding properties that have been or are being rezoned to a light industrial zoning classification. The subject parcel's current uses have been affected by the changes to their property due to the construction of a deceleration lane for tractor trailers off Fort Argyle Road. The petitioner's driveway access has been blocked for the residential properties. The pet resort facility's driveway was poorly reconstructed due to the lane construction road improvements regarding raising the road as well as the slope. The construction for the lane received a permit by GDOT and has been taken over a year to construct. They currently still have the silk fencing up in there. And the existing zoning and agriculture, the adjacent, the adjacent parcel to the east provides a warehouse use and is zoned light industrial. To the west of the subject parcel is a large tract of land that was recently approved by City Council. We have a map of the circled area is a subject property, and then this was currently rezoned. There was a rezoning from business commercial in the front portion, light transitional light industrial in the middle, and then light industrial in the rear portion of the property. The range of uses permitted under the current and proposed zoning classifications are very different. Agricultural 1 classification allows for agricultural areas, forestry, and the preservation of the rural character. The district allows for certain non-agricultural uses that are found in rural areas, whereas the proposed IL zoning classification would allow for a mix of commercial and light industrial uses, including warehousing. The area around the subject property is no longer rural and does include many small commercial and industrial sites. The proposed IL classification would allow for industrial uses. There has been a strong market push for warehousing and small-scale port supporting businesses due to recent growth. Many of the adjacent parcels that are zoned IL in the area are larger in size. The subject site is smaller in size. Current zoning pattern and conforming uses of nearby properties indicate there are pockets of residential and commercial properties along Fort Argyle Road with predominantly large tracts of land that are zoned light industrial or heavy industrial. The character of the surrounding area had been rural in nature and has increased exponentially with industrial, residential, and commercial development. The property has reasonable use under the current zoning classification of agricultural with single-family detached housing and the existing pet resort facility. And to summarize, the area around the subject property is no longer rural and does include many small commercial and industrial sites. The zoning proposal is not compatible with the present zoning pattern. Many of the adjacent parcels that are zoned IL in the area are larger in size. However, based upon the existing zoning pattern and character of the area, as well as the review criteria, staff recommends denial of the request to be rezoned from A1 to IL. However, if there was an alternative zoning classification to recommend, staff recommends the community business zoning classification. It would provide a much needed use for food-oriented retail, general retail, and upper residential uses, which the surrounding community needs. Either way, if it turns to IL, it will still need road improvements due to truck use or to commercial uses, just as the one to the west is with the deceleration lane. So that is all for me. Ms. Williams is here to answer any questions.
Okay. Ms. Williams, would you like to come forward? You have 20 minutes if need be. Please state your name for the record. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Tara Williams, and we purchased the property in 2019 as actually zoned residential agriculture. So it has residential homes on it that we were renting out, and when our neighbors came in and put the decel lane in, they did not leave us with a usable driveway. So that has taken out any way of us being able to use lots A and B as residential at this point. And we are currently surrounded on pretty much all four sides because the decel lane kind of comes in the front and covers almost the entire 350 foot of our front road frontage. With that decel lane for our neighbors, but every other corner that is surrounding us is industrial light. So we are trying to figure out how we survive with our 5-acre lot surrounded by these big industrial companies. So we're looking towards the future as to what we can do with our property, because as we purchased it and as it was intended to be used, can no longer be used for that, except for the doggy daycare, of course, the facility that's there that still is being used.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Does anybody have any questions? Ms. Garrett?
The access is certainly a concern to me. Have you considered using the doggy daycare drive to access the other two properties?
So that would be a commercial mixing with residential. And the only way, if the two residential homes were to use that same driveway, they would be accessing their property through the rear, which is where the septic tanks and drainage fields are.
All right.
And our worry would be they would be parking and driving on top of that.
And commissioners, please state your name for the record when you ask a question. Thank you very much. Anybody else?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Jay Melder. Did you consider an addition or from the IL, perhaps a BC zoning classification that I think the parcel directly to the south of your parcels was recently rezoned? To BC.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
If you considered rezoning instead of light industrial to a community business rezone, I think you stated that you're surrounded on all sides by light industrial, but I believe that to your immediate, if I don't see a compass rose here, but to your south and to your east, that's actually community business. Am I incorrect?
Yeah, that was just recently. I was under the impression it was all industrial light on that track because that's still kind of the process is still going through with that. We had not considered BC. That would be something we would have to look into. We were looking for as much conformity to what was surrounding us that we were just looking for the best option to be able to widen our, you know, what we could do with the property.
Understood. I understand why MPC has made the recommendation that it has, considering the size of your parcels and it being immediately adjacent to that BC. So, you know, my question to you is, would you consider a BC zoning?
Yeah, that would just be something I would have to look into and see what options we would have in that distinction. I have not looked at that just yet.
Okay.
We had our original thoughts were with the trucking companies or with the industrial light around us doing something that would, you know, fit right into that mold just because we were surrounded by it. But like I said, yeah, I did not take into account that they were doing BC with the front of that property. So I just hadn't looked into that.
Understood. And then a question for staff, Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yes, sir.
Did staff look into the community business zoning?
Yes, sir. We did looking for permitted uses and the development standards in relation to it.
Do you know what staff recommendation would have been if this was requested to be a BC?
We would have been approved, approving of it.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Jarrett?
In order to avoid additional costs coming back, would you be willing to consider BC and work with staff and maybe continue this for a month?
Yeah, that's fine.
That's my recommendation too, to table this. Do you think you can have all that done by next meeting, September 29th? Get with staff?
I certainly could.
Okay. Look for a recommendation to
move to continue this to the next regular meeting.
Cole, second.
Is there anyone else here?
That's a good question. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Is there anybody in the audience on this petition? Anybody on the computer? No? Okay. Any further discussion? I look for a motion.
Move to continue this to the next regular meeting.
Second.
We'll do a verbal vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Thank you. That'll be September 29th, ma'am. That'll be on a Thursday. 12, map amendment, 8020 Waters Avenue and 1104 and 1106 Corinth Avenue.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nirav Gandhi, MPC staff. Yeah. So this is This is a petition to rezone three properties at the corner of Corinth Avenue and Waters Avenue. They are currently zoned residential, RSF6, and the petitioner is proposing to rezone them to OI for office institutional use. So to locate them, this is East Montgomery Crossroads down here. This is the intersection with Waters Avenue, and we are a little bit to the north of that. Corinth Avenue would be on the right if you were heading up from Montgomery Crossroads. So for a closer look at the properties, they are right here. As I said, this is Waters Avenue. Mall Boulevard feeds out right here, and this is South University across the street that kind of goes up along Mall Boulevard there. So Corinth Avenue is a dead-end street. There are seven occupied homes on there, and I believe one unoccupied home. And across Corinth Avenue on the other corner here is a church. The subject property has 212 feet of frontage on Corinth Avenue this way and 140 feet of frontage on Waters Avenue this way. Because of its orientation here, which is better displayed with these street view pictures, this is Waters Avenue here. This is Corinth Avenue here. As you can see, this is not really suited to having an access point, and there is an access point already here, which I would assume would be what would be used for an OI use. And this is a closer look at it, but because of the orientation of this property, we would more define it as a, or staff looks at this more as a property that is oriented towards Corinth Avenue rather than oriented towards Waters Avenue. And you can see, like, looking straight down the street here, this is residential. We find this to be a pretty purely residential area. Also wanted to make a note that the same owner applied for a rezoning to OI at this location in 2020, and they continued the petition and eventually withdrew it before MPC heard it. So the development pattern in the vicinity of this subject property is similar to other Southside Savannah neighborhoods that abut these arterial streets. For example, if we zoom out a little bit, across East Montgomery Crossroads and up and down Waters Avenue at this area, you will see a few of these OI spots popping up, especially with OIT, the OI transitional zonings as well. A lot of those are formerly residential buildings that have already been developed and were retroactively turned into small offices. So in RSF6 currently, which is what it's zoned, you would be able to use it for its intended use, which is three single family homes. The lot lines may need to be redistributed, but there is enough square footage and frontage there for these to be split into three lots. That would be large enough for the RSF6 zoning, which is 6,000 square feet and 60 feet of frontage per home. So we found that it has pretty much full use as it's currently zoned. If we were to rezone to OI, there are some permitted uses that we feel could fit in this area, like the aforementioned small, you know, house-based offices with just a few people working in them. However, when we look at these rezonings, we have to look at the full scope of what could happen there in the future with future owners, et cetera. Some of those things are offices which could be, you know, multi-story offices as well, child and adult care centers, medical institutions, some utility centers, a pharmacy, a bank. So there are a good number of things that we feel do not fit the character of that neighborhood in that way. The comprehensive land use plan shows this as a residential suburban single family area, which is, you know, currently what it's zoned for, RSF6. It is served by City of Savannah Water and Sewer. And as we said before, it has access on, or rather it has frontage on Waters Avenue, but because of the character of the property, it looks more like you would access it from Corinth Avenue coming in this way. We have also found that nearby, let me go back to the aerial here. So we've also found that nearby residential uses may be deemed less valuable by the addition of a non-residential use like this. This Corinth Avenue, as we said, is a pretty like squarely residential area. The combined properties, like I said, are large enough to accommodate three residential lots under the current zoning with an adequate buffer from the traffic on Waters Avenue. Let's see. We also believe that adding traffic along Corinth Avenue would pose a significant change for existing residents there. And also a lot of, if not all of the OI uses would require use of a, or building a parking lot. That would require, you know, some disturbance to neighbors on that street. So we find that a rezoning to OI is not necessarily appropriate when considering all of these possibilities. And again, when we do these rezonings, it's not just really what the current owner is wanting to do, but the full scale of possibility of what future owners could do as well. So we have recommended denial for this petition, ultimately because the property is perfectly fine for what it's zoned for as of now. It currently matches the comprehensive plan and would be moving away from that as well. And as I said, a lot of these uses are just not compatible with this neighborhood. We received a petition from a few of the neighbors on this street in opposition to this, and I am open for any questions.
Is the petitioner here?
Yes.
Mr. McCorkle, state your name for the record, and you have 20 minutes if need be, sir.
A PDF today. It's probably down there.
Oh, probably this one then. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert McCorkle from the law firm McCorkle, Johnson & McCoy.
Here on behalf of DAI Commercial, Mike Kistler and Kay Chancey, who are here with me today. As described by staff, the subject property consists of three lots on the corner of Waters Avenue and Corinth. One of them does, in fact, have a Waters Avenue address. I heard the question beforehand during the pre-meeting, and two of them have Corinth Avenue addresses. They do have numbers on the system, but they've never actually been used. So for all the years, those lots have existed there as residential lots. While other houses on the street were being built in the 50s, these lots have remained vacant for more than 70 years since that time. The purpose of this rezoning is to put an office on the property. There is a demand in the area for small office space, whether it be a lawyer or a real estate agent or doctor's office or whatever it is. There's a lot of demand for freestanding office space. We chose OI, office institutional, as the zoning for this because the purpose of OI, as it exists and as it was put into the ordinance years ago before NUZO, and then it kept in NUZO, was to provide areas for offices and similar low impact uses immediately adjacent to residential areas that are in transitional areas. They may not have been in transitional areas when they were originally constructed or laid out, but as time has changed and as staff mentioned, as traffic has been added and Waters Avenue has been widened to 5 lanes, these areas have changed and have transitioned into something different than what they may have originally be planned as. Office, as the definition is, the office and institutional district is established to allow uses as well as a limited number of office uses, as well as a limited number of other uses that are compatible with an office environment. The OI district is intended to be located, one, in close proximity to non-residential districts, and two, as a transition between such areas and residential districts. I've been before y'all on many occasions over the last several years rezoning different properties to OI. Most of them are along Waters Avenue and along Skidaway and other roads like this, Montgomery Crossroads also, that have transitioned and changed their very nature over the years. Staff believes, as was mentioned and as is in your staff report, that this is a very residential area or a pretty residential area that is perfectly compatible for single family residential houses. And that these lots can easily be used for that purpose. And that's the gist of the recommendation for denial. It says that staff finds the rezoning of OI would not necessarily be appropriate for these properties. They can be used to the fullest potential with the current zoning. They could easily be used for the intended use of single family residences. This is just something we disagree about. We believe that the property really has no viable use as single family residential property along Waters Avenue, and that the purpose of this rezoning is to create a viable use. And we also believe that not only are we creating a viable use, but what we're asking for is consistent with the zoning pattern along Waters in this area and the entire character of the surrounding area. I wanted to show some pictures because a lot of the zoning maps earlier were kind of zoomed in and it was hard to see necessarily the kind of bigger picture of what we're looking at here. So if you'll give me a second to give you some context. This is from Mall Boulevard, which is right here, to Montgomery Crossroad. As you leave Montgomery Crossroad down Waters, there are four residential streets that exist in this corridor right here as you go down. Shannon, Madrid, Sherwood, and Corinth. All of them are dead-end streets. Okay, just to give the kind of lay of land here. Obviously, we've got Cary Hilliard's up here. We've got shopping center. We've got large shopping center here, office buildings here, South University. There's a Marathon gas station here and other commercial uses. When you look at the zoning map here, you'll see this is Montgomery Crossroad here. So this is all BC all along the front here. As you back up, you get BN into a certain district distance with residential behind it, then OI with residential behind it, then OIT with residential behind it. On the other side of the street, you have BN with residential behind it, more OI with residential behind it. As you continue to come up, you've got OI all across the street. This is BC everywhere around this corner. And then we have a large apartment complex, which is constructed directly behind us. Many of these businesses have primary or direct access into their primary or secondary access into their businesses on the residential streets that they are on the front of. If you look at this diagram, this will just show access to residential streets that come through commercially used or commercially zoned or office zoned property as you go in this one stretch of property that we're here talking about today. It is a consistent pattern in the area in which this road exists. If we start with Shannon Avenue as we move from Montgomery Crossroads, everyone's familiar with this area. You probably drive by as many times a week as I do. You've got Carrie Hilliard's on the corner here, which every time I access it turning onto Shannon, which is a residential street, residential dead-end street. And you come in there and you pull up and you wait on your food and pick it up just like I did when I was a kid. And immediately adjacent to that, which you can see right here, is the Farm Bureau Insurance Office, which does not have any access onto Waters. It has a parking lot in the rear, which is on a residential dead-end street and is solely accessed on a residential dead-end street there. This property, by the way, is zoned OI. As you go down towards Madrid, we'll come back to that one. As you go down towards Madrid, on the corner of Madrid, you have Islands Interiors and Salon 1184, which are also zoned OI, which also have access and parking area on a single residential dead-end street. As you continue to move down Waters, you've got other individual commercial uses in front of residential in the rear, which do have access on Waters. And then as you come down to Sherwood, you've got the Antioch Baptist Church, which fronts onto Waters Avenue, but does not have direct main access on off of Waters Avenue, and actually has a driveway directly across the street from the subject property. And this, their lots go all the way across the frontage of Waters until you get over to Sherwood. These, again, are not zoned OI or commercial, but it is a non-residential use. So in the stretch between Montgomery Crossroad and Mall Boulevard, there are only two residences that still exist that are on that corner. 8110 Waters, which was built in 1978, and One Sherwood, which is on the other side of the church, which was built in 1961. Across the street on the other side, between Montgomery Crossroads and Mall Boulevard, there are only five residences that are adjacent to Waters Avenue. Those five are immediately adjacent to each other, unfortunately have driveways on Waters Avenue, and were all constructed in 1955. Consistent with that pattern, the house immediately adjacent to us on Corinth was built in 1954, and the house across the street from us was built in 1959. I would venture to guess that Waters Avenue looked significantly different in 1954 and 1959 than it does now, and was certainly not five lanes wide. So this takes us to the subject property. This is the subject property from the street. You can see it looking here across from the five lanes of traffic on Waters Avenue. We saw pictures looking down the residential street, but we not see what looks out from our property. So if you're looking out from our property onto Waters Avenue, you've got a Marathon gas station on the corner, Wells Fargo here. The entrance to the apartment complex is there adjacent. And across the street, looking kind of to the left and directly across from the entrance to the road, you've got South University, which you go in past the library, and you've got the rest of the South University buildings there as well. This is looking directly across the street from our property, which is the Antioch Baptist Church, which again has a driveway here into the property. So with all this, hopefully all of that provides some context as to the specific piece of property and what the zoning pattern is in the immediate area that we are in. And with that, I just want to take a minute to look at the criteria. Criteria, we'll just go through them. Whether the range of uses permitted by the proposed zoning district is more suitable than the range of uses that is permitted by the current zoning district. We believe that they are more suitable. We believe this property is more suited for office use given its location than it is for residential use, partially evidenced by the fact that those residential lots have been there for decades and decades and decades and have had no houses built on them. Over a 70-year period, there was mention of some uses that aren't wanted or desirable necessarily in this site. One, I would proffer to you that the office and OI uses were specifically chosen not to be offensive to residential uses. But there is, I heard event facility was mentioned in the pre-meeting. An event facility is a special use. It requires approval by city council. You have to go back to city council after you're rezoned to ask for that particular use. I do not think this site is suitable for a pharmacy or something that large. And there was a mention of height, which I would also mention that because it's immediately next to the residential, I believe we are limited to the exact same height restrictions that the residential district is immediately adjacent to us. Second criteria is whether the proposed zoning district addresses a specific need in the county or city. There is a specific need for small office. There is a specific need for freestanding small offices for the uses I talked about, for realtors, for lawyers, for doctors, for all kinds of different uses. My clients in the business of building and selling and leasing office space, and they know what's needed and what's not in the area. Next is whether the zoning proposal will adversely affect the existing or usability, existing use or usability adjacent to the property. And this seems to be where the rubber has hit the road in the staff recommendation. staff mentions that it may be less valuable, the properties may be deemed less valuable because of this development. I don't believe that a single 4,000 square foot office, say, on this site is going to render the properties that are immediately accessed on Waters Avenue with all that is constructed around it less valuable. I don't think there's any evidence, if you look at the tax values of the properties on the other three streets, which are dead-end streets, which all have commercial in front of them, there's any difference at all between the values of those properties and the values of the properties on this street. The houses on the street are not worth more because they don't have commercial in front of them now, and I don't think they'll be worth less when they have commercial in front of them. And again, OI was specifically chosen as a transition to be located next to residential. Whether the zoning proposal is compatible with the present zoning pattern and conforming uses of nearby properties and the character of the surrounding area. And that's what my main point is that it is consistent with, exactly consistent with the surrounding area. And I believe that we've shown that it is consistent with the present zoning pattern. And lastly, whether the property to be affected by the zoning proposal has a reasonable use as currently zoned. We do not believe that it does have a reasonable use as currently zoned. We believe that given its location, I don't think anybody is going to want to build a single family residence immediately adjacent to Waters Avenue in that location. These properties have sat vacant for 70 years. They're going to sit vacant for another 70 years, well, it's likely if they remain residential. So the property essentially has no use. And so that's what we're here about today. Now, I will acknowledge that there is a residence being constructed on the street right now. And it's very nice. It looks beautiful. And it's at the very dead end of the street on the back end of the street. And so I'm not suggesting to you that this is not a residential street or that there aren't going to be future houses potentially built on the street. They very well may be, but I do not believe they're going to be built up on Waters Avenue, as it seems to be consistent with the only houses on Waters Avenue in the area were built in the 50s. And we think that this can be done because this zoning was specifically put here in order to allow this to be done without offending the residential uses. And so, again, I'll just close with the purpose of the OI is to allow office uses as well as a limited number of other uses that are compatible with an office environment. It is intended to be located in close proximity to north non-residential districts and may be used as a transition between such areas and residential districts. And with that, you know, that's what we're here to do. My client wants to build an office building on the property. The depth of the site is consistent with the other properties that are rezoned along the frontage. It also gives us enough room to have satisfactory buffer and distance away from that other property. The cars that will be accessing the office, even if they are accessing on Corinth, they're not going way down the road. We're not deep into the parcel. They will be able to come in and get out right there on Waters Avenue, hopefully without affecting the neighbors. I'll also mention, I did send an email out. I got an email list of all of the residents on the street. There is no neighborhood association for the street. And so we were not required to have a neighborhood meeting. I was asked to reach out to the neighbors. I did send an email on the 29th of August to all the information, at least that was provided to me by staff. I did receive one response and asking if they'd be interested in having a meeting. I reached back out to the person. They did not respond back to me. So we did not have a meeting. I was unaware that there had been any emails or correspondence until I heard it in the pre-meeting today that anyone here is to object, and someone may be here in person. But we did try to reach out to the neighbors and have that discussion. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McCorkle. Any questions from commissioners? Mr. Melder?
This is Jay Melder. Mr. McCorkle, of the properties you described that had been zoned office or office transitional along Waters, along Skidaway, along Montgomery Crossroads, are you aware of any of those rezonings in which there was involved new construction or vacant properties as opposed to existing buildings?
I was not involved in any of these specific ones. I know the Farm Bureau office clearly was an old residence that was added onto at some point, it looks like, for the purpose of having the office and have a parking lot constructed. On the other side of Montgomery, I know there are some newish office buildings, newish being not since the 50s. Or since the 50s, but office buildings that are built along there that are zoned in the IA and the OI district. But I don't know of any specific ones in this section that were new construction post rezoning.
Certainly, perhaps not since NUSO.
Certainly, yes.
Okay. And did you and your client give any thought to the office transitional? And what do you see as the difference between office and office transitional as it relates to these properties?
I don't have it pulled up in front of me. You may be able to pull it up, but I believe one of the concerns was that the office transition, at least from my perspective, was that the office transitional requires special use for an office, which was a specific use we were coming to, which requires us to get it rezoned and immediately go back to council to get a special use approval. Mm-hmm. So that was my main concern, at least at looking in the optional districts.
Okay, thank you.
And you know, to the extent that if we want to, I know we've done this in the past, but we want to remove event venue as a use, even though it's a special use or something like that. I don't think me or my clients have any issue with that. The intent here is to have an office constructed on the site.
Mr. Nutrika, do you have a question?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Any other commissioner? Mm-hmm. Mr. McCorkle, are you familiar with the road? If you can pull up a map, I'm trying to pull it up here, that goes in the middle between Shannon, Madrid, and Corinth.
Got a larger map down here.
Place.
What's the name of it?
Marcus Place.
Are you aware there's three businesses in there?
You mean off of the road back in the
middle
street?
Yeah, on each corner. I mean, there's two daycares. There's another business there on the corner, all on the corner.
Yeah.
That's in the middle of that neighborhood.
On each
street, right? I mean, I'm like you. I know that area like the back of my hand, man. I used to go to Groves Daycare School then. I was a four-year-old boy, but I didn't know if you were aware that I'm making y'all aware those businesses do exist with inside that neighborhood and have been for years, decades, man. They've been there for a long 30 plus years. I know the one daycare has been there 50 years. That's been there. There's another air conditioned business there. There's businesses within that neighborhood. And me being, I know the south side of Savannah very, very, very well. This is Waters Avenue is becoming what Montgomery Crossroads now become. There's no homes. And the homes across the street, the little four or five little cottage type homes, those are rentals. Probably one day will be bought out too. But that's all that's becoming from Seawright Drive that turns to go to Benedictine all the way back up to Montgomery Crossroads. All that's becoming commercial. And that's the future. That's where we are. That's really where we are with Montgomery Crossroads. Very, very, very little residential. I wasn't sure if you were aware of those because you didn't point that out.
Yeah, I was not.
I have a question for staff.
Yes, Ms. Jarrett.
Karen Jarrett here. I was wondering, in your knowledge of properties in Savannah, is there a greater need for office institutional or a greater need for residential?
I mean, to my knowledge, there is a great need for both of those things. And especially with residential, I'm sure you're aware we're, you know, suffering from a bit of a housing shortage right now. But I don't know, Marcus, do you have anything else on the need for that? But no, I think both of those things are in great need in Savannah.
So we are experiencing a housing shortage.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Mr. Noah.
I just have a question for staff.
State your name.
Wayne Noah.
Thank you.
Is there any property between on Waters Avenue, between Montgomery Crossroad and Eisenhower, mm-hmm. that faces Waters Avenue on that side of the road that is not office or greater density other than residential?
Right, I understand.
Is there any other than residential from Montgomery Crossroad to Eisenhower Drive?
We could pull up a map real quickly.
Yeah,
pull up stages.
And Mr. Noah, did you say on the same side of the street? I believe that every property between Eisenhower to Montgomery Crossroads on the east side is an office or commercial zoning classification other than multifamily that exists on that side of the street.
We can see Eisenhower is over here, so zoom a little bit, but yeah, that does look to be the case, right down to here. Yes, sir.
Any further questions?
I've got one. Elizabeth Epstein, could you, I'm not as familiar with the neighborhood. Chairman Welch, can you point out those on this map, whether those properties that you say are commercial use, or the non-conforming uses, or?
All four of them, you're right, Wayne. Wayne and I both know this area. Just having grown up in Mayfair, which is across from the.
Where the RSF 6 is in the middle of the neighborhood, the property under the 6, that is where Georgia Farm Bureau was and then moved, but that, all four of those corners.
Have a business on them.
Thank you.
Chairman, I have
non-conforming
question.
Yes, sir. Mr. Coleman?
We have been told, yes, that this is residential use, and but and I'm from Savannah here too, and know this area has not been developing in any way for all these years. The house is under construction now. When was the last house constructed on that street, to anyone's knowledge? Because, you know, other just than, because you can build a house there doesn't mean you will build it. And I do believe that that corner is very undesirable for anyone residentially to put a house there. So while it may be great to say, hey, there's a housing shortage, if no one's going to put a house there, does it really matter? So I think we always need to have a little bit of, you know, what the realities are relative to how the development pattern is and everything else along that street is commercial in some way. And this may help buffer and provide an opportunity to protect those houses further up the street, because something's going to be built there and it probably won't be a house. At some point, someone's going to, the pressure is going to make something happen there in the future. Why not try and make sure it happens in the best way now? But I do want to know about the construction along that street, because I don't think there's been any activity there for probably 20, 30 years.
Mr. Coleman, you're right. The house that was recently completed, which is here, there has been no new houses constructed on Corinth in at least that long.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Melder?
Just to do a little crosstalk with my colleague, Mr. Coleman, because I don't disagree with the with perhaps the diagnosis that this parcel will be pressured into something other than a residential use. And so my question is, how is the best way in which we govern that? And it goes back to my questions earlier to the applicant, which was why not office transitional, which was the reason is because it's a process step.
And I would agree with you there. And I think that when we pulled it up, it did allow office in that when you had it up on the screen. Yeah. So yeah.
Made it use by right in that district.
It just simply goes through the special use permit, which would allow this body and city council to further discuss what's the most appropriate uses for parcels in that area.
Well, to say it's a permitted use.
Yeah, medical office requires a special permit.
Yep.
So if they're looking for a general office, it would be permitted by right in OIT.
Yes.
Any further questions?
I think there may be a size limitation.
Thank you. Is there anybody in the audience sitting here today wish to come forward? Did you fill out a speaker card? Okay, this is you then. Mr. Marlon Favors, please come forward, sir, and state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Marlon Favors. My house is actually the house that is that they was saying that was the last house built on that block. And I actually completed that house maybe a year and a half ago. As we speak right now, there's another house being built in the middle of the block that's already in process for that area. Forgive me a little bit, I'm not prepared as everybody else, because I was just, this opportunity was just on my way to come here to speak on behalf of the residents. I'm basically give you a little bit about myself and why I chosen that block. me and my wife was looking for an area to actually build a home on, and we happened to run across that area, and I happened to ride down that area on a Sunday morning, and I seen all the little kids outside just playing back and forth, and myself living in Savannah, being as a kid, being able to come outside and just play on the street, where you'd have to worry about a lot of traffic, a lot of misfits, and just a lot of negative things. It just enlightened me, and I got a lot of grandkids myself, and I would like them to be able to grow up on that area. Maybe jumping around a little bit to answer a lot of those questions that y'all was asking them, I think on one of the, not jumping back and forth, but one of these streets on Waters Avenue, it is a house right there on the corner. Not every one of those blocks has a business on it, from my knowledge. I'm actually ride by it again, but I'm pretty sure I ride by it almost every day going to work, and it's a house on that on one of those corners. Like I said, it's not a business on every last one of those corners. But like I said again, is the reason why I'm here, because of the other residents, they didn't have time to actually come because they are working. I actually have to be working at 4 o'clock. And so I say that I will come here myself to try to represent the block. And my thing is, I just want to try to just keep the integrity of that block. As far as, like I said, it's only six of us on that block. It's nice, it's quiet. The kids can come out and play. We'll have a lot of traffic, none of that. And I know I'm jumping around a little bit. I'm also a developer also. I actually build homes myself. And one of the questions was stated is, do you think we got a problem with housing, or do we need more housing or office buildings? We definitely need more housing, because I actually sold a couple of pieces of my property about a couple of months ago, and I'm still getting calls from Section A, different tenants and stuff, because people are being misplaced and they're looking for places to stay. And I think that corner would be a nice area to put some houses there. If they give me the opportunity, I would build some houses there for people to actually come and live, and to keep that a nice residential area. So ain't too much I want to say. I just, like I said, I just wanted to come in to speak on behalf of the neighborhood. Like the gentleman said, he actually sent emails and stuff out. Actually thought it was some scam emails. I actually seen it, but I actually seen it today. So I just took it upon myself, and like I said, just slip on some clothes and come and speak on the behalf of the neighborhood and let them know, you know, we just want to just try to keep the integrity of the neighborhood as far as residential, and keep it nice and quiet.
Any questions for Mr. Favors? Mr. Melder?
This is Jay Melder. Sir, thank you for coming today to speak.
Sure.
You've stated that the integrity, your preference and your neighbor's preference would be residential.
Yes.
Is there any other use you see on those parcels other than residential that you think would be an appropriate use?
No.
Do you have any insight as to, for being both a developer in the area and a neighbor there, why those three parcels haven't been developed in seven decades?
Be honest, I just think, for one, nobody knew it was for sale. Because I actually, if you look on the map, it's actually 2.5 acres right in front of me that was actually just sold maybe 3-4 months ago, that somebody actually gonna come and put some more residential houses on, because of the owner, he actually just put it up for sale. I mean, from my knowledge, I don't know, but from my knowledge, those areas weren't even being advertised or sold until I started building my home.
Okay.
And then once I started building my home, then one day, that's when I seen the signs out, these areas are for sale.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Favors? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience on this? We do have one petition online. Diane Kessler. Ma'am, please unmute your microphone. Ms. Kessler.
Thank you very much.
Please state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Diane Kessler. I represent the seller. I am a realtor. There is the apartment complex pool that is right behind or beside these lots. According to Mr. Deloach, there is pool noise, and he does not feel like that would be conducive to a residential homes going in there because of the pool. Mr. Faber said that the property across the street was not for sale, but it has been for sale, and I actually sold two of the lots at the end of the street for residential. There is a drainage issue with the large track because it goes down to some water down there. A lot of fill is going to have to be required before the property across the street from Mr. Favors could be developed. So that's our stance. We feel like that the highest and best use of this property is commercial. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Kessler? No, Mr. Wayne Noah.
Wayne Noah here, asking staff, and this is, in my opinion, relative. The property where the church is, has there been any discussion with MPC about the development of that in the last 6 to 8 months?
Not to my knowledge. Do you hear anything?
Mr. Noah, are you referring to the church property? No, we have not had any discussions with anybody about that property.
Any further questions for Ms. Kessler? Thank you, Ms. Kessler. Anybody else online? Nope. Well, I asked the petitioner if you have the option to come forward one more time, 5 minutes, if you want to add anything.
I don't follow directions well. Just to make the comment that we do agree that we think that this will provide a buffer for the residences. We're not trying to prevent further residences from being constructed in the rear or do anything that's going to harm them. And we do believe that there's no reason in the world that any of the traffic, any of the cars coming to this office or employees coming to this office would go past the driveway into this entrance and go further down into the area where there would be kids playing or anything else. And again, potentially it provides a buffer between going out into Waters Avenue as well. But with that, we just ask for your support for our application. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Dwayne.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Mr. McCorkle a quick question?
State your name for the record.
And it's Dwayne Stevens. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Considering where the existing apron is, the depth of the lots from Waters Avenue, I don't argue that residential is maybe not the best use for, especially right at Waters Avenue, considering the depth of the other lots of office type scenarios. Has it been considered to maybe do the first two parcels as the designation that you guys are requesting and creating even a further buffer so you don't encroach any further into the residential area with that third lot?
I don't think that's specifically been considered. I think the property that's being, my clients have the property under contract, and the property being sold is for all three lots to be used as one development. So that's all they've considered.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Karen Jarrett.
Given the discussion that we've had today, would your client be interested or be willing to look at office transitional rather than OI?
mean, obviously, our preference is that it be OI, but at the same time, office transitional, office institutional transitional is better than no rezoning at all. And so, you know, that's all I can say is that if the determination of this board is to recommend office institutional transitional, then that's what we'll work with.
Thank you. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Just a final reminder to everyone, this property has been vacant for over 70 years from when it was platted.
State your name, Wayne.
Wayne Noah, sorry. And I just feel that if it was going to be developed, any, even multifamily, anything residential, it would have already been done. And if a motion is in order, I'd like to make a motion.
Any further discussion, commissioners? I look for a motion then.
Coles, I make the motion to deny this petitioner's request, but instead approve office institutional transitional.
Coleman, second.
We'll take a vote. Mr. Coleman?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Ms. Elizabeth Epstein?
Yes.
Mr. Joseph Irvin?
Yes.
Ms. Karen Jarrett?
Yes.
Mr. Jay Melder?
Yes.
Dwayne Noah?
Yes.
Mr. Jeff Notrika?
Yes.
Mr. Michael Kegler?
Yes.
Welcome aboard, sir. Mr. Dwayne Stevens?
Yes.
Dr. Watkins is not here. Nobody online? Okay. Mr. Wildwoody?
Yes.
And Ms. Bowles isn't online, is she? Okay. And Mr. Welch, yes. Motion passes. Thank you. We go to item 13, text amendment, medical marijuana dispensary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This item is a text amendment to the City of Savannah Zoning Ordinance, sections 13.2, 5.4, 9.3-1, and 8.4. The purpose of this is to address the medical cannabis dispensary use being added to the zoning ordinance. The those amendments include adding the use to the table of permitted uses within the zoning ordinance, creating a definition, and establishing conditions that are required, that would be required during the special use process. The city is recommending that this use be added as a special use in the BC zoning district with a number of restrictions that we'll go through. And within that district, within that district, it being a special use, it would require MPC recommendation and approval by the City of Savannah in order to establish the use within the city. Going back a few years, there's been a number of legislative actions on the state level, really starting in 2015, related to what's known as low THC products, which is a marijuana derivative. The state has moved to allow creating a patient registry to establish those with qualifying conditions, to expand access to that product for hospice patients, and also provisions for in-state cultivation, which are all overseen by the state of Georgia by way of the Georgia Access to Medical Cannabis Commission. In an effort to prepare for the local impact of these legislative decisions, the city adopted a resolution in March this year, which established a temporary stay on applications from those who were seeking establishing that use in the city of Savannah so that they could prepare ordinances and other procedures for allowing that use. The city staff and officials prepared the various aspects, the safety and administrative protocols associated with managing the establishment of potential dispensaries. And the proposal that'll be before you today is the result of that. So the first thing that they did, and not necessarily in this order, I should say, but a definition was established that will be proposed to be added to the zoning ordinance. That definition is as follows. Medical cannabis dispensary means a business or organization that is granted a license for the sale and distribution of medical cannabis products as defined in state law, annotated and elsewhere regulated by the state of Georgia. They're also proposing to establish the use medical cannabis dispensary as a special use within the BC zoning district. And a number of requirements associated with establishing a medical cannabis dispensary include the separation requirements that you see before you. It states that a dispensary shall not be closer than 2,000 feet to any of the uses that you see under item B. These include a number of civic uses, healthcare facilities, educational facilities, daycares, et cetera. In addition to that, there are a number of submittal requirements associated with establishing the use. This is for the applicant to the city, things that they would be required to do prior to receiving a permit from the city. They will have to have information on the proposed structure regarding the square footage, security requirements, security plan. They would have to identify hours of operation and show that the licensee may be required to provide a safety plan to include public safety measures, security cameras, and so on. And to respond to a comment that was made, a question that was brought up during the pre-meeting, the safety requirements are a part of the state regulation as well. So that's where what was the genesis of these additions to the ordinance. I should add that as a part of this process, as I understand it, the Savannah Police Department worked with staff to come up with a number of the conditions that you see here before you today. Some of the other requirements included basically how the property is developed and what it looks like. So no flashing lights, spotlights, or other similar lighting systems, no electronic message boards. The city's also requiring or proposing hours of operation between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. And that the use shall be in a standalone building, which we discussed in the pre-meeting. The other conditions that you can see here are all part of the special use conditions. I should also mention for the record that the city of Savannah has a number of alcohol density overlay districts throughout the city. Those are areas that have been designated to limit certain sales and dispensing of alcohol, including bars and taverns, restaurants with alcohol, package stores. This use would not be permitted within those overlay districts. Those overlay districts are already defined within the zoning ordinance, and that was a part of the discussion with the revenue department that brought that condition forward. In our review, we did want to bring to the board today for discussion a few other conditions that staff at the MPC discussed. As I mentioned, there is a security plan that is required to be brought forth during the application process. That is similar to plans that are sometimes required through the revenue department for alcohol licenses. We're recommending that there be some discussion today about requiring that plan include the presence of on-site security personnel and not necessarily only cameras, et cetera. That there may be discussion today about revising the hours of operation, and that we have a discussion about limiting signage potentially to one fascia sign, meaning a building sign, and one freestanding sign consistent with the requirements of the sign ordinance. This last portion, I really wanted to just put on the floor today because I know there's a lot of specifics about sign regulations that things you're allowed and not allowed to regulate. But we thought it was important at least to discuss whether or not pictorial representations of marijuana should be allowed on signage, should one of these businesses be established in the city. And that may be a discussion that needs to take place between now and the city council meeting. But we wanted to bring that forward as a topic. But we are recommending approval of the proposed amendment to those ordinance sections. And city staff is here as well to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Coleman had a question.
Yes, sir, Mr. Coleman.
Yes, Cedric Coleman. You provided us with these handouts, which have some highlighted safety plan information on it. And I have a question about it because we're talking a dispensary here, and this information is relative to production facilities. And is there really a correlation between a dispensary of the size that has been discussed here and these production facilities, which are class two at 50,000 square feet and class one at 100,000 square feet, where they are having these really comprehensive security plans that are required? And do we really need the level of security plans that these are outlining for a facility that during the pre-meeting was talked about to be in 1,500 to 2,000 square foot range? Is that an undue burden upon someone to start doing this sort of thing? And you're talking about somewhere where they're growing and producing, not even requiring that level of security. So I want to make sure that this has been fully studied, that we're doing the appropriate security measures for a dispensary versus what I'm seeing here outlined for major production facilities for this type use.
Yes, Mr. Coleman, I think there is some difference between what's required for production facilities, which is what you have in your hand. And just let me go to the language related to security that is being proposed now. And here it is here. Information on the proposed structure, the facility will be located, including total square footage, security installments, security plan, including type of security system, and plans to address operations when security and surveillance system malfunction. So essentially what the city is saying here, and Mr. Melder can chime in if necessary, but I think what they're saying is the applicant, based on this language, has to provide a plan, and then the city will make a determination if that plan is adequate.
Well, I think that if you're going to do this, this is pretty nonspecific. I see a lot of what really needs to happen in this, and this is so generalized that if we're going to require this in the ordinance, there need to be at least some concrete, hey, meet these points, and then, because someone could present almost anything here, you're giving pieces, but not specifics on how to achieve it. I just think that a little bit more definition to make sure that when someone comes forward, that they're able to present a holistic document to you to work from.
Thank you.
Marcus, this is Jeff Natrika. Also in the pre-meeting, I brought up about capping the size of these dispensaries. As much time and effort as the mayor put into to put a 6-month moratorium, and as staff has done in researching this, I can't imagine any scenario in which these should be larger than 1,000 feet of retail with a maximum of 25% of ancillary use, so a cap of 1,250 square feet. Clearly, by the base of the language and the way it's treated, these are quasi public nuisances. So, you know, obviously everyone is very concerned about regulation, which I understand and agree with. So I think not to limit the size of these is a grave misstep.
And Mr. Natrika, I think what we will do, because I know there was discussion amongst staff as they were coming up with these conditions about some of the issues that you brought up related to size. So I'll let Ms. Liddy speak to that when she comes up to make some comments.
Mr. Chair. Okay. Yes, sir, Dwayne.
Dwayne Stevens. I just wanted to kind of chime and bounce back off of what Mr. Natrika was saying. I'm sure we've done our level of due diligence, but I think it's prudent that we make sure we align whatever the state requirements are from a size standpoint. I know the Board of Pharmacy requires a certain square footage for that type of use inside of whatever spaces. So I would guess that with these types of things coming up, there would be, for medicinal uses, it could align with something of that nature. So I would make sure, I think it if we're going to speak to the size of the spaces, we should consider those things if we're going to include size being a requirement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Lawson, I guess I'm going to be a little bit, you know, we consider alcohol to be semi-nuisance when it comes to liquor stores, which is why we have the overlay districts and what have you. I think that, I mean, we see these liquor stores having some major sizes that involve,
right,
and their nuisance is just as much as anything. What makes the cannabis dispensary in and of itself a nuisance relative to the alcohol abuse out there that's created by the use of liquor stores, and why we aren't limiting the size of those stores in an appropriate manner and the damage they do to the community from that standpoint? So I guess we can make all the arguments in the world about why something could be a nuisance and you want to limit its use, but okay, you have a 1,000 square foot store and now you have 50 stores to make up for what the demand is, you know, from that standpoint. So how do you get around all these things? Understood. Even with all these things? So I think that there are ways to create enough rules and regulations that in and of itself, the economics will limit the sizes of these stores with all the other things that you have here, and give us some time to determine whether a limit on the size of these stores is appropriate as opposed to putting something out here right off the bat. And I don't see anything to support 1,000 square feet, right, or 1,500 square feet at this time. Not to say that it can't be done, but shouldn't we try and get this ordinance in place and then look at whether there's further modifications necessary as it gets enacted?
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, we're not recommending, or the city's not recommending a maximum size at this time. There is no maximum building size. I think their thoughts around building size, some of it was related to the fact that they probably believe that a lot of these uses, when they're established, will be repurposing of existing commercial buildings. In addition, I will say that the major limiting factor here, in terms of the nuisance issue, if we want to call it that, is the separation requirements. I think when you think about 2,000 square feet separation from a long list of uses, that's going to cut down a lot of opportunities, even within the commercial districts where this is going to be permitted.
Yes, and I make no argument about the separation from other uses. I'm speaking plainly to the discussions that have been happening on this panel about the size of the actual business.
Understood.
Being things. So, mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman.
Also, too, Marcus, Jeff Notriga, we're talking about, I believe, a Schedule II narcotic at this time.
I believe low THC is classified as a Schedule II narcotic. Mm-hmm. Not an expert on that issue for sure, but yeah.
So, I mean, this is completely different from alcohol, which is not scheduled as a narcotic.
Oh, I see your point.
Ms. Jarrett?
Okay.
Yeah, just before Ms. Jarrett, yes, China, I just want to, for those who are listening, perhaps, I just want to make sure the public understands that we're talking about medical cannabis dispensaries and low THC products, not recreational marijuana usage.
And you have to have a prescription for it, right?
Correct.
So I don't understand why it can't be sold in the pharmacies. But
thank you.
My concern here is the security plan, the additional security requests in our recommendations for on-site security personnel. You know, for a 100,000 square foot growing facility, they're not requiring an on-site person. They require 24-hour video surveillance, mm-hmm, which I think is laudable. And I think that's where we should be focusing our attention on security, is meeting the requirements of the state. And going above the requirements of the state, I don't think is a bad thing, but making it onerous to someone who might want to have this business is something that I'm a bit concerned about.
Well, I understand that. And let me just say this, that as it relates to those final three bullets at the end of the report, we really wanted to bring those to the board as more of a discussion point, really, in this meeting, so that you can make a determination on whether or not to consider any of this language as a recommendation to the council.
Mr. Melder?
This is Jay Melder. Really want to just appreciate staff's time and due diligence on working through this issue and looking at other places in Georgia which are also tackling this as a result of the state action. I think that, you know, some of the issues that we need to consider around security It may not be so much from a nuisance perspective, but this is a cash business, a cash only business, and security there is going to be really paramount. The other thing too is, because we're talking about medicinal marijuana, is a discussion that I was having with staff earlier, is, you know, how do we, are there ways in the ordinance where we can really incentivize placing these facilities in our medical districts as well, which tend to be less residential, if this is for medicinal use, correlate with those medical purposes as well. So those are questions that I have, and that staff, and that we are continuing to look at as well.
Thank you, Mr. Melder.
Joe Irvin.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair. My cursory read of this, what I'm looking at here, when I look at the state law, we do have some hemp dispensaries in Savannah, do we not?
Do you know the answer to those?
CBD?
CBD, yes. CBD, yes.
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 I was at the meeting here. I need one of those. but having said that, to me, the confusion is, and I think Ms. Jarrett may have hit on it, and I heard my fellow commissioners on my left and my right touch on this as well. If we're looking at something that a doctor has to prescribe and requires a prescription, and I was reading the requirements that they banded about by state law, it would appear as if this is something that not only does a physician have to prescribe, but logic would dictate one would have to go to a pharmacy to get it.
Well, in this case, is not the case. I mean, you're probably right about the logical aspect in terms of, you know, where you go to get this product, but apparently, based on the state law, a standalone business that is not a pharmacy can be established as a dispensary, and you can take your prescription there and collect the product.
And for a dispensary, in and of itself would be, this is just me and I'm reading a little bit, this sounds more quote unquote recreational / pharmaceutical, as opposed to strictly pharmaceutical.
And I think it's only pharmaceutical from the standpoint that it has to be prescribed. A medical cannabis dispensary is essentially a one product pharmacy.
And that's where I was heading at with this. So we've carved out a special niche for a particular business.
But does a pharmacist have to prescribe it, Karen Jarrett? Does a pharmacist have to prescribe it?
Yes.
I mean, does a pharmacist have to?
Well, there is
a physician has to prescribe it. Does the pharmacist have to fill the prescription?
Oh, that I can't answer. I do not know the answer to that. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
While he's coming up, I just wanted to remind you also that there's a limit to the number of permits issued based on population. I know we haven't really talked about that, but right now we're looking at about four of based on our population. So keep that in mind as well. And generally, they do have people that are trained. The planners just across the country have looked at this issue based on the number of states that already have this approved. And you do have someone, when it's a medical entity that basically is there, you have to give the person your prescription the way that most of them are set up. And they check everything. And then the prescribers are people that have had additional training on filling that prescription. That's what, from a planning standpoint and from the write-ups that I've seen on this issue in other jurisdictions, that's what is done to fill the prescriptions.
Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Wayne Noah, going off of Mr. Melder's comments about in a certain area or zone where on staff's report it says it shall not be located, are you recommending, am I incorrect, it shall not be located within 2,000 feet of a healthcare facility? But is that specific? I mean, or is that, I mean, honestly, can we hear from Ms. Liddy? I think she's probably going to answer 90% of our questions up here.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and members of the MPC. My name is Bridget Liddy. I'm Director of Planning and Urban Design with the City of Savannah. Thank you for having me here today. Just to go through some of the questions that were raised, in reference to our efforts in crafting this language, we worked directly with the Savannah Police Department, the Chief of Police's office, to go ahead and proceed in coming up with some guidelines as far as conditions go that would assist them as well as our community in protecting our residents. They did a lot of outreach to some entities in Atlanta. We specifically looked at Alpharetta, Doraville, as well as DeKalb County. And they also reached out to a couple other folks in Atlanta and the Atlanta General Metropolitan Area to talk about this option and what needed to be included. The good news is that they said that there weren't a lot of issues with their contacts that they made, that they spoke to, but they did want to have specific language included in this ordinance as conditions to address a public safety plan. I think someone had mentioned, I mean, the city manager mentioned this is a primarily cash business, and that's a very big concern to them. And so having that public safety plan in place as a condition was very, very important to them. To let you know, the language that we have here is mimicked off of our alcohol ordinance, where we have additional language in here asking for any kind of revisions, and the licensee has to go ahead and provide those revisions to us. In reference to the cap and the size, Mr. Nortrika brought up of the actual structure itself, in the Savannah Police Department's conversations with their peers, they did not see a need to go ahead and limit the size of a facility, understanding that, you know, they're probably not going to have a lot of other retail items for sale, so the spaces will probably gravitate to a smaller size space. I will say that we've had a lot of individuals who have contacted our office and are very, in the city of Savannah in general, and very interested in having one of these licensees from the state to come down here. And they are one of the persons, I think, Ms. Wilson mentioned this in the pre-meeting, was a company that had banks. And the banks were downsizing because everybody's got their bank on their phone, right? And so that seemed to be like a perfect scenario for this type of operation, where you've got the facility designed in a way where safety is paramount and you have a vault in the facility. Does that answer some of the questions? Yes, sir.
Ms. Lady, Travis Coles. With regards to having security personnel on property, I understand this being a higher cash volume business, but I don't think we require that of pawn shops, right?
No, we don't.
So I'm not clear as to why we're including that specific requirement. I think that's more of a business owner's discretion than government enforcing them to have security on property. The other question though is going to have for staff is, have you identified like corridors or properties that would fit all of the requirements that we have in this? Like, there's a lot of things that it can't be within 2,000 feet of, which kind of narrows down where it actually can be. So have you identified properties that it could
be?
So
we've created a map that identifies the BC zoning district, and with that identified residential land or zoned land. And then we've also looked at community facilities that are around there. The one challenge with the medical facilities piece and kind of steering them to the medical facilities piece is that, that those districts are typically zoned office institutional, and that's where we see a lot of our schools. And so there's kind of a conflict with that. I will say, Mr. No, you brought up a point about healthcare facilities and in parentheses substance recovery facility. So do know that healthcare facilities is like a category within the use table. And we're calling out specifically a substance recovery facility. We're not calling out all of those institutions that would potentially serve as a pharmacy or a hospital.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Melder?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just add it to the discussion about this being most appropriately done at a pharmacy. I think we would all agree, but until the federal government changes its policy on cannabis, then pharmacies, which have to comply with Medicaid regulations, they're not going to be able to adopt the sale of this, which is why there's a carve out specifically.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Nobody online? Look for a motion.
Move to approve staff, or move to approve staff recommendation, with the exception of the recommendation for an onsite personnel, security personnel.
Cole, second.
Discussion, Chairman?
Yes, sir.
That can, do one now? No.
Yeah.
Should this pass under the current motion, that can be required when it goes.
To the city.
To the city, correct?
Yes, sir. Two things can happen from this stage. Once the board forwards a recommendation, the council can adopt that recommendation or some version of that recommendation. The other thing that can happen is that once an individual comes before the council for an actual license, they can add any conditions because it's a special use process that they choose to at that time.
Thank you.
We go to a vote. Mr. Shedrick Coleman?
Yes.
Mr. Travis Coles?
Yes.
Ms. Elizabeth Epstein?
Yes.
Mr. Joseph Irvin?
Yes.
Ms. Karen Jarrett?
Yes.
Mr. Jay Melder?
Yes.
Mr. Wayne Noah?
Yes.
Mr. Jeff Natrika?
No.
Mr. Michael Kegler?
Yes.
Mr. Dwayne Stevens?
Yes.
Mr. Tom Woodworthy?
Yes.
Mr. Joe Welch? No. Thank you. Now we go to presentations. Item 14, City of Savannah Impact Fee Program.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned in the pre-meeting, the City of Savannah staff has been working on an impact fee program with a consultant, and they're going to present that where they are with that process today. It's in draft form right now, so it will be shared with the council at an upcoming meeting, but we wanted to brief the board on that before the City Council meeting.
Do you want just the popcorn?
Yeah, I got it. This. Oh, yeah, I'm looking right at it. Sorry.
Good. Okay, great. Good afternoon again. Bridget Liddy, Planning and Urban Design with the City of Savannah. It's a great pleasure to be with you all here today to talk about our impact fee program. Many of you all have your deliberations about, you know, issues with infrastructure not being in place and public facilities not being ready to serve the growth and population that we're experiencing and we will be experiencing with all the new development coming in. And so the city late last year went ahead and approved a contract with Ross and Associates in order to go ahead and proceed with doing a impact fee program. And so we are here to report out to you as far as what an impact fee program is and where we are in the process, and also ask for your assistance because part of the process ties into the comprehensive plan as an amendment. And so it's important that we have that relationship with the Planning Commission in order to ensure that everything is moving forward as a package. So what is an impact fee? An impact fee is a one-time charge to new land development to defray costs of our expanding capital facilities in reference to growth that's coming down the pipeline. And the new development pays for its fair share of the public facilities needed to serve future growth. As far as the state of Georgia, we have a very regimented state code that tells us how we need to go ahead and proceed with setting up an impact fee program. The good news is we have examples across the state from small jurisdictions to larger jurisdictions and counties and everything else in between. How are impact fees regulated? I mentioned that OCGA 3671, which is the Georgia Development Impact Fee Act. I mentioned it has to be linked to the comprehensive plan. within the context of the state law, it only allows jurisdictions to charge for certain public facilities. So you'll see the list of public facilities. There's seven of them that are listed there. The funds, once they're collected, it cannot be used for regular maintenance or operational expenses. That all has to be handled by our general fund. And there's also a 3% of the fees collected that can be used to help administer the program. So collecting it and allocating it to various projects. Within the city of Savannah, we have identified out of those seven categories, four key areas that we're focusing on to collect impact fees: parks and recreation, fire protection, law enforcement, and road improvements. As part of the state code, it requires us to set up an impact fee development committee. Many of the people you might recognize, the seven people might know who they are. We have an active website that has minutes from the meetings, as well as just general updates about what we've been working on. Committee meetings have been scheduled starting in early January when we established the committee, and then February all the way through. And our next meeting will be on Friday, 9 o'clock, over at the Adams Complex. If any of y'all are interested in attending, please feel free to join us. So where are we in our process? It's kind of a four-part process based on this graphic, and I'm going to walk through it with you. So we worked on a methodology report earlier this year. The methodology report primarily focuses on projections and forecasting population growth all the way through 2045. So we're really looking at what kind of growth trends we're going to see, where we geographically this growth, the growth will occur, in order to identify what needs we need to start going after. So those public facilities, what are those items that we need based on where we see the growth happening? So in the methodology report, it kind of crunches all this data together, and it spits out a compilation of how much a maximum fee would be charged for various uses. For example, if there's a hotel use, there's going to be a dollar fee set aside that was going to be charged per room. If there is an industrial property, there will be a square footage rate for the amount of industrial property that is going to be developed based on the formula that we have. I will say one very important feature: we have not set that maximum fee yet. So if there's anybody out there in the internet world, tap the brake. We're in the process of looking at that, and that will be something that will be determined by our mayor and council with guidance from the city manager. But we do have those limits or those maximum fees already outlined in our draft methodology report. So that's phase one. That's done, off the list of things to do. So now we're moving on to phase two, which is the capital improvements element plan. And this is part of the comprehensive plan once it gets adopted. And it basically takes the information from the methodology report, crunches it down a little bit more in detail, and projects what those items are going to be that will be set up for the next 5 years. So what will those capital projects be? Where will the road improvements be? What will the police station be constructed? It'll also highlight not only the impact fee revenue that comes in, but also other fees that might be needed in order to support the development of those public facilities. And so as we move forward with that process, we are here today just to let you know that that draft document is living and breathing. There's actually an attachment as well as the methodology report on your agenda. We will be presenting that to mayor and council on Thursday and asking them for a recommendation to go ahead and transmit that to the Regional Development Council down in Darien, as well as DCA. Very similar process to what happened with the comprehensive plan. It's in draft format, so if there are any comments or concerns that you have as you look through the CIE, please let me know, hopefully before the next meeting, so we can get that information and transmit it to our partners at the state level and down in Darien. And from there, once they do their review, which should take about 60 days, we will come back and actually formally present the CIE to you all, ask for a formal recommendation, which will go to mayor and council in the form of a resolution. Now, going back to that methodology report and those maximum fees I had mentioned, we will, simultaneously as the CIE is going through the sausage-making process with our partners, we will be drafting an ordinance with guidance from mayor and council to figure out what those maximum fees will be charged. And then that fee schedule will be adopted as we proceed in adopting the CIE. So you're probably like, Bridget, is there a big difference between the methodology report and the CIE? For all intents and purposes, the methodology report gives birth to the CIE, but the CIE goes a little bit, it goes a little bit deeper and actually creates the 5-year community work plan, which looks at those 4 categories: parks and recreation, fire protection, law enforcement, and road improvements, and really crunches those numbers down to give a comprehensive approach, as I mentioned before, as far as when these projects will be coming down the pipeline, how much they will cost, what's the timeline with them. And then as we go through this process, the CIE will be from 2023 to 2027. After that 5-year window, we're going to have to go back and update it again if we want to continue updating or using the impact fees. So our timeline, we're here today, just as an FYI, thank you very much, Ms. Wilson. We'll be doing the public hearing with council on Thursday and also have them adopt a resolution to submit the information to our regional partners. And then we will go ahead and wait for them to give us that information back within 60 days, come back to you all as mentioned, and then we'll do the local adoption for the CIE. And then following that, with the development impact fee ordinance, we have to go through and look at exemptions that might be part of the impact fee program, which would include extraordinary economic events or affordable housing, setting the actual fee schedule, as mentioned, conducting some public hearings to make sure our community knows what's going on, and then move forward with a local adoption. And this is our timeline. I don't know if you can tell with the last 2 columns, the column of November, we will have that ordinance and the CIE coming down the pipeline at the same time. So everything will be seamless in reference to what we're doing with the impact fee program. So that's my presentation. As I've mentioned, it's more of an informational thing for you all. Appreciate the time. And this is an exciting program, and hopefully we'll be able to proceed in addressing some of the concerns and issues that we have out there for our public facilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Jarrett.
Karen Jarrett, I did notice that schools and sewer and water were not included in the 4. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. So the state law states that what the requirements are for the list. Libraries and related facilities are on that list, but that's something that the city did not pursue. As far as the water piece, we already have a lot of we already have a impact program that's set up with the tap-in fees. In addition to that, we are also looking at other funding mechanisms to help with maintenance of our water facilities, and that might come in the form of a stormwater utility fee, but not now, later in the future. But okay. Great question, and that has come up but multiple times.
Schools are not included in the Georgia law, huh?
Nope. Right.
Thank you.
No problem.
Very cool.
Jeff Natriga. Bridget, looking through this, got a couple of questions. One, what is the current impact fee for a single family home?
So the current, we don't have an, are you talking about the water and sewer fee, or are you talking about the maximum impact fee?
So when we're done with this, we'll have 2 different fees. We'll still have a water and sewer fee, and we'll have this new impact fee. Mm-hmm. So looking through this, it looks like a single family home, just adding up the 3 category, well, 3 of the 4. I didn't see a table for the 4th category about streets, but it looks like a single family home is about $3,100. Then the police department is about $1,000, and then about $1,200 for fire. So just those are going to put an impact for a single family home at over $5,000.
That's incorrect. Okay. Within the methodology report, there is a table. I'm not sure what page it's on, but the table actually outlines different uses. So it'll start with residential uses, industrial uses, commercial uses, etc. And depending on what your use is that you're constructing, there will be a fee associated with that. I believe for the single family residential, the fee is just under $5,500 per unit.
Okay.
So that would be an example of that. And that's all in your attachment on the methodology report.
Now, did you look at breaking Hutchison Island off separately from the city itself? It looks like it's got a lot of extra heavy cost to it, like a new fire station that needs to be constructed and other capital improvements. And I was wondering if that was something that would be appropriate, because it looks like if Hutchison Island is included in this, the rest of the city is going to be subsidizing a brand new construction city.
So when we looked at the different items on the list, we cast the net and we looked where growth was going to be happening within the city of Savannah. There will be growth happening at Hutchinson Island, but there's also growth happening in western portion of the city of Savannah. And so with the list that we have on the CIE, you will see that there are certain items that are listed there, public facilities related to public safety, roads, et cetera. And that's kind of the list that we're looking at for the first 5 years. And there's a timeline for when they would be pursued based on the 2023 to the 2027 timeline.
It seems like based on the price for a single family home construction over $5,000, the amount for hotels and motels is extremely underweighted at approximately $300 for a hotel and $69 for a motel.
Per room. So that's per room. Room, right.
Per room.
So that will add up relatively quickly. When we were meeting with our development impact fee committee, there was a lot of discussion about why certain uses, i.e. hotels, were not included in the table. We went back and we revised that, looking at taking out a lot of park space in order to allow for the hotel use and some other commercial uses to be included in our fee table, because that was something that our committee felt very strongly that it should be shared across the board between all of the different uses, which I thought was a good idea.
Well, and to be clear, I'm more likely to be paying impact fees under a hotel than I would under building single family homes. But even despite that, it seems like building a 50-room hotel at approximately $15,000 versus three houses at $15,000 doesn't seem equitable.
So if you consider a hotel is a transient guest, a visitor that's coming and going. In addition to that, when a person is coming to the hotel, chances are they're only going to be here for a very short period of time as well. Whereas you have a person who lives in Savannah who is going to be here 365 days of the year, having a greater impact. And when we did the methodology report, we also looked at impacts with transportation and other growth projections in order to get our numbers.
Well, and I would say a hotel actually overweighs all those, because most of the hotels now are at over 80% occupancy. So while as an individual person might only be there a short time, there's another one coming behind them. Not to mention that everybody that comes to a hotel, the great majority are going to be having some sort of public transportation or driving cars. It just seems like that segment's underweighted in their contribution.
We'll look at it. Our committee is meeting on Friday. We'll talk about it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Melder.
Jay Melder. Bridget, clarify the difference between the maximum fee described in the methodology report and then the fee that the mayor and alderman may choose to adopt.
Sure.
And how they're able to scale that up and
down. So currently in the methodology report, you have a list with those uses of the maximum fee that could be charged for that particular use. Mr. Notrika had just kind of gone through some of those items. So what's going to happen is when this goes in front of mayor and council for the adoption of the ordinance, there will be discussion as far as what is that level that we need to charge the user. Is it going to be at that maximum rate, or will it be at a lower rate that could potentially get changed later on down the road by mayor and council? So even though there's a maximum fee that's listed in the methodology report, that is not what has been adopted or approved. That still has to go through a vetting process. And in many cases, communities will go ahead and adopt half of the maximum fee moving forward in order to ensure that they're able to deliver the program.
Bridget, Jeff Dentrick, and one other question, and I might have missed this section, but is there any specific section addressing adaptive reuse versus new construction?
I don't believe there is, but that's a good point. I'll check into it.
That's a good point.
And typically this is for new development. So any other questions?
I have one. If the roads in many of the subdivisions were interconnected throughout the subdivision and the surrounding area, would our road fee be reduced?
I'll have to look at that, but primarily our road fees are generated by trips. So I'll have to look into that to see if that would be an option, but that's a good point.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Jay.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, you're suggesting perhaps that the impact fee could incentivize connectivity by reducing an impact fee
yes,
for
sir.
Roads that are more connected than
exactly.
those other products. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Next, we go to other business, report from the nominating committee. Who's going to speak?
I am. It's Wayne Noah on behalf of the nominating committee, which was myself as chair, Mr. Dwayne Stevens, and Mrs. Elizabeth Epstein. We met at length, well over an hour, and had very good discussions where we were, where we've been, where we need to go. And at the end of the day, our nomination slate of officers is as follows. Chair, Dwayne Stevens. Vice Chair, Travis Coles. Secretary, Tom Wywoody. And Treasurer, Elizabeth Epstein. That completes our report.
Thank you, sir. And I will take nominations on the floor, and I will start with one. And that's Wayne Noah as Vice Chairman.
Chairman, I'd like, Jeff Dontrica, I'd like to nominate yourself for another term. I've been on the committee a very brief amount of time. I've been very impressed with the way the meetings have been run and with the decisions we've made, and I'd love to see you continue.
Thank you, Mr. Dontrica. Anybody else? You got that, Wing?
I do.
Can I have the rundown again, please?
Okay, as chair was Dwayne Stevens, vice chair Travis Coles, secretary Tom Wywoody, and treasurer Elizabeth Epstein.
With two nominations on the floor. Wayne Noah, vice chair, and Joe Welch, chairman. Anything? Any further discussion?
I make a motion we close.
And we vote on next meeting, September 29th. Please remember that is on a Thursday, not a Tuesday. Okay?
I make a motion we close nominations.
Second?
Coleman, second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone against? Thank you. Everybody have a blessed week. We thank you, staff, for all your hard work that you put forth for this meeting. I look forward to the next. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.